question because I have a stick, not a pointer. So thank you, Federico. So thanks for having me here. By the way, I think this is a wonderful place for being researcher, I guess. I mean, you know, better than me. So the title has been slightly changed from the advertisement. As you can see, I will talk about some specific topics in bridging this gap between some aspect of fundamental physics and gravity wave observation. By the way, of course...
Is it your computer?
Oh, sorry. I've been talking for too long. So, I have 40 minutes, 45, say. Yeah. Okay. So what was it? Yes, of course, I mean, you might think gravity waves are, I mean, trivially linked to astrophysics, and astrophysics, it's fundamental on its own. But what I mean here by fundamental is really fundamental in the sense that high-energy theoretical physicists mean it. And, yeah, so let's start with an outlook. So what are we talking about? So we start, I mean, maybe this is something you are very well familiar with, but I will introduce what are the linearized Einstein equations, I mean, what is the basics of the... of the gravity wave theory. I mean, what I mean by gravity waves, how do we interact with matter. And then I will give you an overlook of what are the experiments, which are the detectors, which are really now there taking data, and what are the prospects of the detectors. Then I will flash you some basic element of data analysis. I mean, you might not want to hear about data analysis, but it's just one slide to tell you what is important. I mean, after all, if you want to give a theoretical input to the experiment, you have to know what the data analyst, I'm one of those actually, are using. And then I will go to the main topic, I mean, of the interface between fundamental physics and gravity waves, which is some specific sources of gravity waves I'm studying, which are coalescing binaries. So I will point out how many of those we expect to see in the forthcoming years, and what is the modeling we have available at the moment, and what is the inputs the fundamental physics can give to this modeling. As you see, I mean, there is one other aspect that you might be familiar with at the interface between fundamental physics and gravity wave observation, which is gravity waves in the primordial universe, stochastic backgrounds. This is, of course, very interesting, and there's a lot of activity on it. I will not talk about it. I mean, that will be the subject of another long talk. So... I hope you didn't came here for that. Very good. So let's start with the linearized Einstein equation. I mean, very basic introduction. I mean, these are all trivial, basic things, but let me just stress the points I will use later. So you have a metric. You expand around Minkowski, and then you have a small perturbation around Minkowski. This perturbation is much smaller than one. Of course, there might be some gauge issues, but I mean... Let's expand around Minkowski. Let's consider all the perturbations in a specific gauge I will specify later to be small. So the gravity wave is not any perturbation of the metric, but it's a perturbation which is endowed with a high-frequency behavior. So only the high-frequency part of this H mu is what we call gravity wave. So, of course, the Einstein equation are very complicated, 10 nonlinear Kaplan equation. I mean... partial differential equation, so we can reduce to much simpler one by linearizing in the perturbation and by choosing a specific gauge that kills all the mixed coupling. So in terms of this variable H bar, which is defined here, so the 10 equation decouples, and so each of them at a linear level, of course, just depends on the mass content of my theory. Then, of course, there is some... specific, then there is the gauge invariance of general relativity, which is not completely fixed by this gauge choice, but is reduced in the sense that my diffeomorphism is bound to satisfy this condition. And I can make some diffeomorphism if I keep in this gauge condition, if I allow the shift function to satisfy the box equation. So what I want to tell you here, okay, this is something you might know, but it might not be completely trivial to everybody. So I have 10 degrees of freedom. I mean, that's, of course, because it's a symmetric tensor, rank 2 tensor. So 4 are purely gauge. 4 are really not physical. Are just there because of the gauge. I can get rid of them by choosing a specific gauge. 2 are really radiative physical degrees of freedom, which are the gravity waves, properly said, those that the experiments aim at detecting. And then there are 4, I mean 4 plus 2 plus 4 is 10, 4 which are physical but are not radiative. I mean, this is something you shouldn't, I mean, it's also very natural. That's also happening in electromagnetism. You have 1 degree of freedom, which is pure gauge, 2 which are the radiative part, and 1 which is the Coulomb part of it, which is physical but is not radiative. It's the 1 over r part. And here, too, we have 4 physical non-radiative degrees of freedom. By the way, this wasn't realized immediately, but it was Eddington that realized a few years later after GR was published. And he pointed out by saying, I mean, there is this funny expression that is, he said that these degrees of freedom and these ones, they propagate with the speed of thought, because he was the first to realize they do not propagate with the speed of light. They're not radiative degrees of freedom. So, for instance, by getting rid of the 4 gauge degrees of freedom, I can write the metric in this way. This is a 3x3 metric. Sorry. No, this is a 4x4, and this is its 3x3 part. I have the gravity radiative part, and I have 2 degrees of freedom, plus 1, 3, plus 1, 4, that satisfy a Poisson equation. That's much like the Coulomb degrees of freedom in electromagnetism. These are physical, but are just not radiative, because they don't have a box in the equation. So, after this somehow lengthy introduction, let's go to, I mean, what is the basic of this interaction with matter, with experiments? I mean, this is, again, I mean, something you might know already very well. I mean, if a gravity wave is present, it changes distances. Or if you like, it changes the distance between two nearby geodesic lines. So basically, if I have a light going back and forth in my path, then the interference curve of, I mean, if I have an interferometer, the light will experience a different path in the two arms of the interferometer, and the dephasing of the light will be proportional of the stretch of the length, which is also proportional to the gravitational wave. Or, equivalently said, I mean, if I have a body made of stuff, I mean, a mirror, or, I mean, a slab of matter, which is somehow hang to some spring, it will undergo some force, which is the second derivative of the gravity wave which is passing. So if I have a mirror which is reflecting the light, it will undergo some force by the passage of the gravity wave, and this is the force. Okay, very good. So what is the gravity wave? How do I relate the gravity wave to the source? So in the transverse traceless gauge, which are the two components of the radiative part I taught you before, the strength of the gravity wave is related just to the double time derivative of the quadrupole. I mean, as you might have heard many times, I mean, a source which is spherically symmetric doesn't emit gravitational radiation. You need really something which has a time-varying quadrupole. I mean, this is the strength, and from this you can get the flux, which is proportional to the square of the triple derivative of the quadrupole. I mean, this was originally Einstein's result. I mean, he's very textbook physics. Okay, let's go to the experiment. I mean, I guess this you should also know, and also if you attended the colloquium last Wednesday, which was part of the gravitational wave conference held here, you know the gravity waves have already been observed. I mean, there's no doubt about it. I will show you how. There is this binary system, which is composed of two neutron stars. They are orbiting around each other with a period of a few hours. So the frequency is 10 to the minus 4, 10 to the minus 5 hertz. So by observing them only for a few periods, you can compute with very good accuracy what are the physical parameters of this system, like the projection of the semi-major axis onto the line of sight, the eccentricity, the period, the time variation of the periastron shift. This is Einstein delay. Okay, I won't tell you what it is. I mean, if you really want to know, I can tell you later. It's a bit technical. And this is the time variation of the period. All of these quantities are observable. I mean, assuming GR, of course. You assume GR is valid up to 1 PN. I mean, no, sorry. All of these are really observable. I mean, are experimentally measured. And from this, assuming 1 post-Newtonian GR, I mean, what is post-Newtonian, I will define it later. I mean, assuming GR at 1 perturbative level beyond Newtonian physics, you can compute the mass of the pulsar and the mass of its companion. Then out of this, you compute, using GR, the time variation of the period. Of course, if the system is conservative, the period must stay the same. The time variation of the period is just the fact that you emit gravity waves. So you observe this, you compute through one post-Newtonian physics this, and you compute through the non-conservative dynamics of GR, the time variation of the period. Very good. And then what do you have? You measure basically the angles. This is something you measure. You measure the angles that the pulsar makes, I mean, by orbiting around its companion. And this must be proportional, I mean, basically, it's one of the period, which is also time varying because I have the emission of gravity waves, so the period is not constant. It would be constant if I didn't have emission of gravity waves. I integrate this, I Taylor expand the period, I mean, I get this formula. So basically, I mean, it's straightforward to see that the phase accumulated by the pulsar orbiting around its companion grows linearly with time. That's normal, I mean, as the period were fixed, but also as a part which is quadratic in time, just because the period varies. And this quantity is computed through GR, through the knowledge of the mass parameter of the system, through the observation of this. So this quantity is computed, I mean, it's not, I mean, there's no fit to do, it's just one computation. So if you plot the phase accumulated minus the linear part, experimental, observed, versus the predicted, you should see the points lying over an inverted parabola. And these are the results. So this curve is not a fit. It's a prediction of GR made on the observation made in the last few, in the first few days of the orbital parameters of the system. So this is a prediction, it's not a fit. And the prediction matches the experimental values up to one part over 1,000. So, I mean, this is a proof that gravity waves have been observed.
They've not collapsed yet.
No, because they are basically 100 million years from coalescence.
Ah, okay. So, yeah. The prediction relied on what the masses were, right? And those were inferred by comparing to those other things on your list.
Yes, those were inferred assuming GR at first perturbative level beyond Newtonian physics.
There's a sense in which it is a fit.
Well, but it's a field, but on independent data. I mean, you just use the first few days of data, because in the first few days you already have many, many periods, because the periods...
Really good, yeah. Very
yes, very precisely. But then you just use what you got here after a few observation, a few days. You got the masses of the system. That's it. And then independently you fit all... I mean, and then you match all of the rest of the data.
And it's very, it's the same spirit as electroweak precision measurements, right? There's three things that are really, really well measured.
Yes. No, I mean, it's true what you said, provided you keep in mind that those parameters are computed from here.
Yeah.
And the prediction of the rate of change is valid all the way to here.
Yeah.
Okay. If you agree with, I mean, I can accept what you're saying, yeah. If you keep in mind also this.
Yes.
Okay. Then let's go and talk a little bit about the experimental status. So this is the basic arrangement of a larger interferometer. Basically, I mean, I'm not at all, I mean, working on the hardware or anything of this, but I mean, basically this is a Fabry-Perot in the sense that the light is splitted. It goes back and forth in one arm, back and forth in the other arm. If the gravitational wave passes and affects one arm differently than the other, then you get that the interference fringes changes. And by the time variation of these interference fringes, you can go back and get what was the gravity wave that has passed in that very moment. So how many of these do we have? Okay, before talking gravity of large interferometers, let's go back. Let's make a little bit of history. Large interferometers, they were not the first gravity wave detector to be conceived. The first gravity wave detector to be conceived were bars. Basically, you take a slab of material. It has some fundamental frequency, which is related to the acoustic mode of the system. So if the gravity waves arise and excite exactly that frequency, then you get your bar to oscillate and... I mean, from the amplitude of the oscillation, you can measure the amplitude of the wave that hit the detector. So there was one bar near Perth in Australia, which, I mean, basically was shut down some 10 years ago. There was one bar in Louisiana next to one of the LIGOs. I will tell you in a moment. This bar was shut down 3 years ago. And then there are three bars which are still working. One is at CERN in Geneva. One is in Rome, okay, near Rome, in Frascati. One is near Padova. So all these bars are still working. I will show you later the sensitivities. But their sensitivity is not matched with the large interferometers. The large interferometers, we have three now working. One is Virgo, near Pisa. Each arm is 3 kilometers long. And there are two more interferometers in the States. One is in Louisiana. Each arm is 4 kilometers long. And this is a twin interferometer in the state of Washington. So now we have three large interferometers, two LIGOs and one Virgo, with really comparable sensitivity. Then we have also a small interferometer, which is only 600 meters long. This is GEO in Hanover, in Germany. Okay, this is also an interferometer that is no longer taking data at AMA in Japan, but in Japan they have some other interferometer I will tell you in a moment. So, what are the sensitivities? So these are the experimental sensitivities. Don't bother about these spikes. I mean, these spikes are really narrow. When we do data analysis, these are cut out and there is no loss of data, basically. I mean, they look strong in the picture, but they're really narrow. They can be cut out very easily. So the red curve is Virgo. So you see at high frequency, the frequency we're talking about is 40 hertz to a few kilohertz. At high frequency, the sensitivity is more or less the same. Whereas the back at the top sensitivity, LIGO is slightly better because it's slightly longer, 4 kilometers against 3. At low frequency, Virgo is again better, is a bit better because apparently Virgo has a slightly better suspension system. I mean, basically this part of the noise is just seismic noise that makes the mirrors at the end of the interferometer to oscillate. And apparently Virgo has managed to do this isolation system better. And as a confrontation, you can check, this is a typical bar, Auriga, for instance, the bar in Padova, sensitivity. As you can see, it's narrow because it sees something only if it excites the fundamental mode. And the sensitivity is a couple of order of magnitudes worse. But you have to think that these bars were working not far from this sensitivity since 25 years. I mean, they've been there since the 90s, at more or less this level. Whereas LIGO and Virgo, they came only the last few years. Okay, and I didn't report the sensitivity curve of GEO, but GEO is shorter, so its peak sensitivity is at least 10 times worse than LIGO. So at high frequency, is only two, three times worse. It's not really taking data now, GEO, actually. So these are the prospects of the interferometers. So there are the two LIGOs, one in Louisiana and one in Washington, which are 4 kilometers long. There is Virgo in Italy. So there is the small GEO, and there is CLIO, which is another Japanese interferometer. It's very small, as you see, compared to this other one. It's only 100 meters, because it's a prototype. It's a prototype of a large interferometer they have planned to build, which is 4 kilometers long, and it will be placed in the Kamioka mine. I mean, those of you who do neutrinos, they should know about the Kamiokande experiment. So that's the very same place. They want to put this large cryogenic detector. And the reason to go underground is, in Japan they don't have much flatland first, and then because the seismic waves are usually superficial. So if you go underground, you get screened somehow from seismic waves. But, the prototype is working, but it's only 100 meters. The large cryogenic detector, which will be underground, will be cryogenically cooled, and which will be 4 kilometers long, is still in the project. Then there are these cylindric antennas, which are working right now, and the sensitivity I show you is not really good. I mean, Auriga, Nautilus, and Explorer. Okay, then let me tell you, there are if you ask around, nobody will ever tell you that there are also spheres, just because they're not taking data, but they are in their commissioning run. It means that the experimentalists working on them are trying to tune the parameters in order to get some reasonable sensitivity out of them. But, they exist. One is in Leiden, in Holland, and one is in São Paulo, in Brazil. Yeah, they work better. Okay, there is one thing. Okay, this is, let me open a little parenthesis. They are a bit better than the Auriga Nautilus because they use, more modern technology because they're being built right now instead of 20 years ago. So basically, according to studies, I didn't show a picture, but what do they do is that at 3 kilohertz, they can be a factor of, less than a factor of 2, worse than LIGO, but only 3 kilohertz in narrow range. But this is on study. This is not real data. And one thing about these spheres is that they are spherical, so all of the 5 quadrupolar modes can be excited by the wave. So this LIGO and Virgo, the output is only one data stream. So you need really the three detectors in order to infer all the characteristics of the wave. Whereas one single spherical detector gives you five independent information about the wave, which is two polarization and two angles of arrival. So basically you have a redundant system to constrain. So in this sense there, they could be very useful. The problem is that really to make them work with low noise and everything. But I mean, if they work with low noise, then it would be very useful to work them in coincidence with LIGO because they can give really a more complete information about the wave. And the fact that they are the three killers just depends on their size. I mean, the fundamental frequency is just the speed of sound divided by the length. So you make them bigger, you can span any order, any frequency you want. The fact that the frequency they are sensitive to is around 3 kHz and wide around 300 Hz, and these 300 Hz, you cannot do much about it. I mean, since you have to excite some fundamental mode, you cannot really make a broadband. I mean, with some electronics, you can make it a bit wider, but you cannot really go wider than 200-300 Hz. So they will be narrow band anyway, so, but they will be here, say.
For interferometers, when they move, I can see it from interference.
Yes.
And these things, if they vibrate,
they measure the displacement of the surface. You excite some acoustic mode, and basically you monitor the fundamental one, and basically the surface oscillates. Surface of the.
You have sensors.
You have sensors, of course, you have electronics to amplify, you have to amplify by hand or the mic to the surface motion, of course. Yes. Okay, this was to say about Sphere, because, I mean, there's somebody who involved quite a lot of time, I mean, to build the pipeline of data analysis for the Sphere. It's not being used so far because there are no data, but these people that developed it, I mean, they include myself, so we're very, we hope that at some point. Okay, so what are the prospects? LIGO and Virgo are LIGO is running right now since July last year. Virgo is now off because in January they shut it down because they wanted to make new suspension system. And Virgo will resume data taking in July, basically in 4 weeks from now, 25th of July or something. And they will run jointly again till fall 2010. Then LIGO is already planned to shut down for the major update that will involve the going to advanced LIGO. I will show you later the expected sensitivity for advanced LIGO. So advanced LIGO is supposed to start taking data in 2014, 2015, so after 5 years of, you know, doing a lot of work on laser suspension system and hardware and all sorts of hardware. And Virgo is supposed to do the same. Virgo will stop just a few months later. It's not decided yet, but a few months later than next fall. And then again, undergo some 4 years time of hardware upgrade and start taking data jointly with the two LIGOs again in this data. In the meantime, how do we cover the gap? There will be GEO-600, the small interferometer and another, which will have a reduced sensitivity with respect to the LIGO Virgo now. And there are the bars, possibly, that will monitor the gravity waves in the meantime in this gap period. Of course, they will have reduced sensitivity, but if something catastrophic like a supernova in our galaxy happen, they will be able to see. And then there are the future project. There is DISA, I haven't told you about, but it's basically the same idea as LIGO and Virgo, to have an interferometer, but instead of having it on the Earth, to have it in the space, orbiting around the Sun. So basically the idea is that since in the space you don't have seismic noise, you can go to much smaller frequencies. LISA is planning to send up to the space Pathfinder, which is a technical mission that will prepare the scientific mission. So the technical mission will be launched next year or in 2 years, and if this is successful, then everybody hopes that the full LISA will be funded. So we might be able to see LISA data, well, not earlier than 2020. Then there is the large cryogenic detector in Japan. That last week, we had the very good piece of news that it was the first 3 years of the LCGT work has been funded just last week. The full construction of LCGT, the cryogenic detector in Japan in the Kamioka mine, will take 10 years. So these 3 years won't be enough, but, I mean, everybody thinks that if they agree to fund the first 3 years, I mean, they shouldn't stop after 3 years.
So this is the Japanese government has funded?
Yes, just Japan.
Yeah. And is the Kamioka mine, I mean, does it already have a 4 kilometer?
No.
They have to dig?
Not all of it, but I think the major of it, yes, they have to dig it. Mm-hmm. That will cost a huge lot of money to dig, I mean, but they're willing to undertake the effort. And then there is this project. This has not been approved or anything. I mean, but there's still discussion, and there are discussion about it. People are confident.
And this Australian, basically an Australian copy of LIGO.
Basically, this will help in source reconstruction. I mean, if you have a very different, the more, I mean, just heuristically, the larger is your baseline, the better you can triangulate the source, I mean, very heuristically. And also here, the time scale is about 10 years, I mean, to see the first data. I mean, all LIGO and Virgo, this is really a plan. It's fully funded. I mean, there is a timeline which is there. All the rest, I mean, you could see fluctuation of a few years. I mean, LIGO and Virgo, I mean, they should really not take more than 2015. I mean, it's everything planned and settled. All the rest is much more shaky, the time scale, I mean. Okay, so what would be the sensitivity of these future interferometers? So this would be the advanced LIGO, and this would be the Japanese cryogenic detector. I mean, these are really preliminary curves. You shouldn't really trust them with more than a factor of few. But, I mean, that would be more or less comparable. So, and basically in the same band as LIGO and Virgo now. So maybe a bit, they go a bit lower in frequency, down to 10 hertz, and up to a few kilohertz. I didn't report here the LIGO and Virgo now, but it's a factor of 10 worse. LIGO and Virgo now is just 10 times worse here. And this would be a sketch of the LISA curve, which will be basically the same sensitivity, so a few 10 to the minus 24 as best sensitivity in as advanced LIGO, but will be much smaller frequency, 10 to the minus 3. So why go to lower frequency? Basically because the mass is the charge of the object. I mean, we're talking about neutron stars, black holes, they will emit gravity waves. So the more massive they are, the stronger will be the signal. But the more massive they are, the larger they are. It's not like in particle physics that more mass means less distance. Here, more mass means larger distances, just because the structure radius grows with the mass. So basically, you expect to see larger signals from more massive objects, but you expect also to see it at lower frequencies, just because, I mean, two large objects cannot get too much close to each other because they are fat. Yes, there is an idea for emission here, but it's planning stage. It's even more, it's even less advanced than the other projects I mentioned before. So I really don't want to talk about projects which are really, I mean, too far fetched. I mean, more whose plan is more than 10 years plan. I mean, it's beyond that. The thing that is people talk about building here is called DESIGO, like DESI LIGO, to cover this band. And it should also be some space mission, but I mean, it's very, very, I mean, misty, I mean.
Isn't the point that basically, LIGO is as far down as you can go on the Earth, more or less. And if you go to space, you want to just go ahead and go down to the farther down where there's better signal anyway?
It's
not a hole there because of some technical limitation necessarily. It's just, you're going to go ahead and put satellites up anyway and spend $1 billion. You want to go to where you expect the signal to be most, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's just, I think it's worth saying that. It's not that it's a lack of imagination that's the only gap.
Yeah, as I said, since you want to look at the most massive system that you might think of, it's better to go to lower frequency. Because massive systems are large, and this is the frequency that you expect. So, I mean, this is the best region to go. I mean, here, basically, by causality, if you get two neutron stars orbiting around each other, the closer they can get, of course, the distance is related to the frequency, the maximum frequency they can give you is 20 kilohertz. Of course, this is really the causality limit. The real limit will be a bit smaller. If you translate this by six order of magnitude, so instead of object of 10 of one solar masses, you get object of 10 to the 6 solar masses, like we know there are the supermassive black holes in our galaxy is 10 to the 6 solar masses, then you move from 1 kilohertz to 10 to the minus 3 hertz. So basically, these are kind of objects you see here. You multiply, you shift by 6 order of magnitude in frequency, then you get objects which are 6 order of magnitude more massive. So this is the rule of thumb.
So maybe I should just say, There is one big advantage of going into space, but at frequencies above, at about 0.1 hertz or above, which is that there's no white dwarf. There's no white dwarf anything background. And so that's like, that's a big stochastic floor, at least at frequencies. So in the future, again, it is more futuristic than this. In the future, there will be a lot of advantages to going to slightly higher frequencies, to right in that gap.
Yeah, of course. The rule of thumb that I gave you, that to relate the mass to the frequency, it works. I mean, for the last stages of the coalescence, where really the distance is comparable to the object. But basically, two neutron stars can give a signal at arbitrary low frequency. Of course, you just set them very far apart. The problem is that signal will be, I mean, very very small in amplitude. So I mean, the rule of thumb I'm giving you is to tell you, I mean, what is the typical frequency at which the signal gets the highest? The typical frequency at which the signals get the highest is the frequency related to the distance, to the Schwarzschild radius of my object, because that's the closest they can get. So that's the highest frequency they can produce, and that's the highest signal they can give. So, okay, let me give you. I should speed up a little bit. So, why it is important? Now I want to convince you with this slide that it is important to have a good modeling of your signal. I mean, if you just turn on your experiment, you look for excess noise, you won't see anything. I mean, it's very hard to see anything. But if you know very well what you're looking for, then you might have some chances. Because let's suppose that the signal is a sum of the output of the detector is a sum of signal plus noise. And let's skip to the last line. And let's suppose that I know what the signal is. Then this is not really what is done in practice, but this is just a heuristic. Then I multiply the output of the detector by the signal I know in advance how it will be. Then look at this. I get a term which is always positive, and a term which is positive and negative. Basically, this term will step out of this other one, even if its amplitude numerically is smaller, just because I can integrate over its duration, and will add up coherently. So this is the basic of a mesh filtering. So if you know the signal you're looking for, you can dig it up from the noise, even if its absolute amplitude is smaller than the noise. Okay, this is something you must be more familiar with than you think of. I mean, when you turn on your radio, I mean, if you choose a random frequency, you only hear noise. But if you tune the receiver to the right frequency band, then you will hear your radio broadcasting station very clearly. Basically, if you know what is the frequency band or what is the relative amplitude of the signal in different frequency band, and you adapt your receiver to match that shape, then you will hear the signal loud, even if by looking just some excess noise at some random frequency, you don't hear anything. Okay, so mesh filtering is important. And this is what is usually done in that analysis. So in LIGO Virgo, so there is a joint data analysis group. So Virgo people access LIGO data and vice versa. So there are four kinds of searches. One is for burst, which is just any unmodeled excess noise. I mean, you have your stream of data, you get some unusual excess noise, and that's a sign of a signal. You search for, and this is unmatched, because it's just looking for whatever signal that steps out of the noise. And then there are three searches which are matched. Okay, let me skip periodic, because I'm running out of time. Let me be a bit brief. So there is the stochastic search that basically takes the two streams of data, and if there is a stochastic signal everywhere, underground, underlying all data, then you expect that by correlating LIGO's detector with Virgo detectors, the output of the different detectors, the noise will decorrelate, because you have no reason to expect that the noise in Washington State is the same as the noise in Pisa. But then you expect the stochastic signal will be correlated. So you expect that this match filtering, this correlation of output, will make the noise step out. So that's why to look for a stochastic signal, you must have always at least two detectors in coincidence. Okay, and then there is the signal from coalescing binaries. In coalescing binaries, I mean, the signal is emitted all throughout the coalescence. So, I mean, you have a neutron star orbiting around another neutron star or a black hole orbiting around another black hole. And the signal is extremely sensitive. I mean, it's actually determined by the dynamics of the system, which is GR or whatever other theory you have in mind. But basically, the shape of the signal is determined uniquely by the dynamics of the system. So if you manage to recover the signal, that means that you have information about the dynamical theory that rules the motion of the system. Okay, and I will talk later a little bit about SNR, signal-to-noise ratio. This is the formula for signal-to-noise ratio. So if you are able to match exactly the signal, and basically you take the Fourier transform of the signal square, you divide by this sensitivity curve noise that I showed you before, and this is the signal-to-noise that you will obtain. This formula doesn't apply if you do an unmatched search. So if you just look for an excess of noise. But if you're looking for something you know the shape of, then this is the formula for signal-to-noise ratio, which is the magic number to look at in looking for signals. So now let's come to sources. I mean, I've talked about the basic of gravity wave interaction with detectors. I talked about what are the experimental situations, both on the observatories and the data analysis side. Let's see what is expected to see in the near future. Okay. So there was the science run of LIGO, which ended in 2007. Could have seen a pair of neutron stars at a distance of 30 megaparsec, which is just beyond the Virgo cluster. So it's already quite a good sensitivity. The advanced version of LIGO and Virgo will have comparable sensitivity in the plans, at least in their advanced version, will have a sensitivity 10 times larger, so they will see 10 times farther. So for neutron star, it's planned that they would spot them up to 300 megaparsec. And for tensor masses, black hole pair, since these are more massive, the signal is stronger, they can go up to 1 gigaparsec. So we are really reaching cosmological distances. What are the rates of this system? The problem is that looking at astrophysical models, the prediction for the rates are very hugely uncertain. I mean, you see there are three, four orders of magnitude uncertainties on which are the rates of these coalescences. But let's take these values. These are the rates per Milky Way equivalent galaxies per mega year. You multiply by the number of galaxies. The number of galaxies, of course, raises like the cube of the distance. So if you increase the sensitivity of your experiment by a factor of 10, it means that the rate goes up by a factor of 1,000. So it's really a huge increase that LIGO and Virgo Advance will have on the first, on this run of LIGO. So basically, if we trust the most optimistic rates, then we'll see in advanced LIGO and Virgo 400 neutron stars per year, 400 neutron star binary coalescence per year, and 1,000 coalescences of black holes roughly in the range of roughly of tensor masses each. So this is according to the reasonably optimistic estimate. If you take the reasonably pessimistic estimate, you go down by a factor of 10 to the 3. So you are on the marginal case. So this is to tell you that LIGO and Virgo Advance are expected to see coalescences on a routine basis. But if they don't see them on a routine basis, if they see one every 2 years, that's also possible according to present star formation rate model. Or put it conversely, if advanced LIGO and advanced Virgo don't see any coalescence, then they can put some non-trivial bound on the model of astrophysical evolution of stars. But of course, we all hope that, I mean, we'll see 50, 100 coalescences per year. But, I mean, there are huge uncertainties, I mean, to be fair. So, and how these models and how these sources are modeled? 10 minutes more? You have a binary system made of two black holes, or black hole and neutron star. I mean, some very compact object. I mean, the neutron star radius is only 3 times, 4 times larger than the Schwarzschild radius of an object with the same mass. They orbit around each other, and you can follow the orbit using Newtonian physics. Is not enough. You can really go beyond Newtonian physics and use this perturbative series, which is called post-Newtonian, And that you can follow to basically third perturbative order, third 0.5 perturbative order. We'll define later what it means, third 0.5. And by using this perturbative series that expands beyond Newtonian physics, then you can follow this inspiring part of the system. Then at some point, there will be a very short phase in which the two objects don't inspire anymore. They just merge one to the other. And then finally, you have one single object that will be highly excited and it will emit the extra radiation by dumping, by damped oscillation. Okay, in particular, this phase admits a very neat and clear perturbative modeling. This phase admits a very clear and neat perturbative modeling. This not, I mean, this has somehow to be guessed as the bridge between the two perturbatively described phases. So, okay, this is to give you a feeling of what are the sensitivities. So these are the noise curves I showed you before. So this is the spiral of a neutron star pair. This is the spiral part. As you can see, it's long. I mean, if you could trace it back in time, it would extend basically forever. I mean, since the time they capture each other. And then at some point, you see a slightly change in the slope of this curve because that's the merger phase. And here the ring down, and then the signal drops. So basically, most of the signal is really in spiral part. Then you have the merger, which spread over some frequency bins, and then you have the ring down. So for low masses, the signal spreads to high frequencies, but of course, it's smaller than the signal for high masses. So for instance, if I get to 15-15 solar masses pair, I get the in spiral is higher, but it moves to lower frequencies. Then I get the merger and the ring down. And this is for a pair of 40-40 solar masses. Basically, I only see the merger and the ring down. The spiral is not in band. I mean, of course, here I exaggerated. I put this system in 1 megaparsec, I mean, just to show how strong they can be. I mean, if this system existed in 1 megaparsec, we would have already seen them. But this is to tell you that, I mean, higher masses means higher signal, but down in frequency. So for high masses, it's really important to model the last part. Whereas for low masses, the spiral alone, it's okay.
So how do we model it?
Okay. Basically, skipping all the details of what is the derivation, I mean, you need to compute only two functions. The energy of circular orbit, which in the Newtonian case is just minus 1/2 mv². I mean, this is just Newtonian physics. And that it acquires correction at 1 pn level, 2 pn level, and so on, where the pn parameter of expansion is the velocity square. And then you need the other function, which is the luminosity function of the power emitted, which has, this is the lowest order in GR. Okay, in Newtonian physics, there's no luminosity. That's strictly zero. This is the lowest order in GR, which goes as V to the 10. And that you get all kind of corrections. Here you get also odd power, because, I mean, there's no time reversal symmetry in dissipation. So here you get also odd power from V to the third. And then what do you do? You want to integrate the phase. You want really to catch the phase of the system. This is because what I told you earlier, the match filtering system needs that you know the shape of the signal. So it doesn't really matter if you get the amplitude wrong by some factor. But you need to know the phase with absolute precision. Not even relative precision, but absolute precision. You don't want to be off by 2 pi after following 1,000 cycles. You really want to be off in the following the phase by less than one, no matter how much phase you already accumulated. So in order to do that, I mean, there is a trick here. Basically, you can compute the accumulated phase just by using the knowledge of these two functions, the energy of circular orbit and the luminosity function. All of them, they have an expansion in terms of V square, so you get this formula, which goes as 1 v to the 6 in the leading term, and then as all of this correction. Because of this v to the 6 in the denominator, you get to know the 3 pn. If you don't know the 3 pn, which is v to the 6, basically you are missing something that once integrated is larger than 1. So you don't want to be off by any factor which is larger than 1. You actually want to know the phase by a factor which is smaller than 1. That's why the tracking of the phase, which is what is done in match filtering, really it's a probe of the physics at 3 pn, at least at 3 pn. This is the very crucial point. I hope I made it clear. I mean, maybe I should move on because I don't have much time left, but please ask me again if this is not clear. Basically, this is the basic match I want to take home. I mean, The tracking of the phase, which is done by doing mesh filtering gravity wave experiment, basically gives information
about the up to the 3PN dynamics of the system.
So all these coefficients are
unknown. Yes, yes, unknown. Unknown. They've been.
In GR, in principle, I can calculate everything, but in alternative theories, I would have different coefficients.
Of course, if you have your favorite theory alternative to GR, sit down and compute this coefficient, and in principle, they will be tested. I will tell you why, in principle. Okay, all of these coefficients up to 3PN in the conservative part and 3.5PN in the dissipative part have been computed by this tremendous work, which actually took 20 years by Damour, Blanchet, and collaborator. And it has been really an amazing piece of physics, amazing work they've done. Okay, and just some detail here. Okay, the number of cycles which is accumulated by this observation of the phase, of course, is inversely proportional to the mass of the system, because if the mass is higher, then the signal goes to lower frequency, then at some point the detector is not more sensitive, so the higher the mass, the less cycles you accumulate. And also it depends on the cutoff frequency, the lower edge at which you start taking the signal. So basically, but then at the same time, the signal is stronger if the mass is higher. But a higher mass gives you less cycles. So the two things partially compensate in that the signal is basically proportional to the mass of the system, to the 5/3, but also to the square root of the number of cycles you can accumulate. The number of cycles goes inversely proportional to m. So basically, at the end, you get a proportionality, which is still a positive power of the mass, but it's milder than what you naively expect. It's only to the 5/6. This tells you that if you go to higher masses, even taking account that you have less cycles, still you gain in sensitivity. But the point is that you have fewer cycles to take track of. So if you really want to test your alternative theory of gravity, then you have fewer of these corrections that matters if you go to high masses. If you really want to track all of this correction to high level, you should really go to low masses, so to have many cycles, but then be careful that the sensitivity of the sensitivity in general will be smaller because you're looking at lower masses. Okay, let's skip this. Okay, this is just, I wanted to flash you an example of a waveform for two spinless system, for two spinless black hole. This is the inspiral. Basically, you can follow the inspiral up to here, then in a couple of cycles you have the merger, and then here is the ring down, this damped oscillation. This is just an example of two equal masses black holes of, I think this is tensor masses each. This is what is being used for mesh filtering. Okay, all of what I said so far was for spinless system. So all of this correction here, just depending on the two masses. And actually, since these are dimensionless numbers, they cannot depend on any dimensionful parameters. They're only depending on this symmetric mass ratio, which is this combination of masses, M1, M2 divided by the total mass square. So basically, omega is a dimensionful quantity, so it will have an overall dependence on dimension, which is embodied by the total mass. But then all of these coefficients just depend on this combination of masses, this dimensionless combination of masses. This is because you have, for spinless black holes, you have no other quantity to play with. But if you have spins, then the things change. Because at 1PN, the spins do not enter, but at 1.5, 2PN, and so on, all the components of the spin, they do enter. Of course, whenever you have a spin, by parity conservation, you have to have also the angular momentum in your formula. But this is to tell you that if you're looking for a system for which you don't know anything a priori, then you might use, the knowledge you infer from the prefactor and for this factor to guess the masses. You can use the knowledge you get from this factor to get one component of the spin. This factor, you get information of another component of the spin. But in general, since you have only 6 or 7 on this coefficient, you cannot fix, you can fix barely all. You can fix only the spins of the system and the two masses, but you don't have enough coefficients if you look at the post-Newtonian expansion of the phase. So if you really want to test your theory, which adds some other dependence here, you really need to give some more information than just the phase. So this is basically the main problem when you want to deal with a parameter estimation. Let me recap this. The template bank that are being used so far, they all involve the two masses. So it's assumed that the match filtering is done for spinless binaries. Why this? Because if you allow for spins, that means 3 degrees of freedom from one spin, 3 degrees of freedom from the other spin, you get 8 degrees of freedom, and it's impossible to build a bank with 8 degrees of freedom. This is just because if you want to check your data against by letting only two parameters vary, you will get some, I don't know, 1,000 waveform to confront with your data. But if you want not two parameters vary, but 8 parameters varies, the number of waveforms that you have to confront with the data increases exponentially. So basically, it's no longer feasible. I mean, for 3 parameters, you might do it, but for sure not with 8. So the template bank, which are this bank of waveforms you confront with the data, they cannot be built reasonably beyond 3 parameters. So if you really want to track the phase depending on all these extra parameters, what the track is not doing the match filtering, but is doing something else. There are some Bayesian inference method. Basically, you always do the template bank with only 2 parameters. You assume that the waveform will not be too much different if you allow spins. And you assume that you might see some excess of some excess of data, some excess of signal, even if you are confronting it only with the two parameter family waveform. Okay, this assumption, of course, has been tested. I mean, I don't give you now the details, but you can quantify this test. So then you say, I've seen something that exceeds my threshold. So I do a follow-up. So after this, I do some Monte Carlo Markov chain method. I do some other thing, which means I produce some billions of waveforms by letting vary all the physical parameters, spins, whatever extra parameter your modified general relativity gives you. And then I really get a huge lot of waveforms, much more than it started with. But then on only the small chunk of data on which I initially spot the excess. So that we can do it. I mean, we can do an intensive search if we manage to isolate somehow a chunk of data which is interesting. But we cannot do an intensive search for all the parameters on all the data. But if the template bank, which initially depends on only 2 parameters, shows some excess, then there is some follow-up analysis that is run in the fully-fledged method with the fully-fledged theory. I mean, to give you an example, there is this group which is doing, is simulating LISA detector output, and they try to recover the signal they inject. And the usual precision they can get is this for the masses and this for the spin at relatively high SNR. So if you really look only at this phase, I mean, you can, okay, with this high SNR, 10 to the 2, 10 to the 3, you can only recover the physical parameter, mass and spins, with that precision, which is, as you see, is not fantastic. So it will be very hard to recover extra parameters you might want to put in the formula if you use only the phase. Okay, this is, to give you an example, this is a waveform, a simulated waveform for a mass ratio which is 100, for a spinning system. I mean, it can be very different from the one I showed you before from spinless system. This is just for the sake, you know, of illustration. Okay, and then, okay, a very few minutes left, but let me give you some flash of what you can do in applying effective field theory methods to gravity. Basically, as I told you, all those computations that are relevant for the building of template waveform have been done already, and they achieved wonderful results computing all the 3PN corrections. Okay, recently it came out a paper that showed that all this computation can be redone in an effective field theory framework. What are the advantages of an effective field theory waveform, of an effective field theory framework? Basically that, okay, first, if you come from particle physics, they're much easier to use, okay. Second, I mean, they admit a very neat dimensional analysis that immediately allows you to spot which are the contribution to which order in perturbation theory. Like, I mean, in QED and QCD, you have a clear understanding of what is the parameter of expansion, and you know which parameter contributes to which order. So there is a clear expansion in Feynman diagrams, and there is a clear separation of scales. In particular, you have three scales which are relevant here. The size of the black hole or the Ingolstadt, the size of the object that sorts the gravity waves, the distance between the two coalescing objects, and the gravity wave wavelength. And there is a clear hierarchy between these three lengths. So the size of the object is of the order of the sparsity radius. The distance between the two objects, I mean, it varies with the evolution, but it sets a scale R. And then there is the gravity wave wavelength, which is R over V. So it's longer than the distance between the binaries. And basically, I can associate to the gravitational dynamics mediating the gravitational interaction between the two is the gravitational force is mediated by these potential gravitons, which are the gravitons that satisfy the Poisson equation I told you before. These are not the radiating degrees of freedom. These are the gravitons that are not on shell. They cannot go to infinity because their momentum is 1 over r. And these are the gravitons which are sourced by the static source, the neutron star, the black hole. Whereas the gravity waves are really on shell, and they can propagate to infinity, and they really represent another length scale. This is R over V. It's a much longer scale. So basically, with this clear separation of scales in mind, okay, let me skip this. Okay, what you can do is you can start with your fundamental Lagrangian and split the graviton into its potential part and its radiative part. Sorry, this is the radiative part and it's the potential part. So I know what is the dynamics of the graviton. I know how the graviton couples to my masses, to my neutron star, to my black holes. So the potential graviton is the one responsible for the dynamics. So once I integrate it out, just by usual, I mean, I know the fundamental theory, I just do the effective field theory computation, I do Feynman, perturbative computation, I do Feynman diagrams. What do I obtain? I obtain the Lagrangian for the binary system, in which the potential gravitons are integrated out, and I get this dependence on their distance. I get the effective action for the pair of for the binary pairs. And then, if I keep the long wavelength radiation, gravity waves, then I get the coupling, say, the 0-0 part of the graviton, which is couples to the energy of the system. Of course, then it's not radiating. The energy is conserved. The 0-1, the 0i part of the graviton couples to the angular momentum, which is conserved, it doesn't radiate. Then the ij part, which is in the transfer traces part, is the only radiative part, couples to the double derivative of the quadrupole, and that's the real radiative part. So in this effective picture, I get an action for the two bodies, which depends on their distance, and then I get the coupling that is predicted by GR, because, I mean, I'm doing GR here, I'm just, you know, finding what I was supposed to. So you could say, okay, why doing all of this work? I mean, after all the corrections have already been computed up to 3pn, 3.5pn. I mean, why should we rewrite all of this? Okay, because you can answer new questions. For instance, this diagram is the diagram that gives you the potential interaction at Newtonian level. This diagram is one of the diagrams, not the only one, that gives you potential interaction at 1pn level, first order beyond Newtonian theory. This diagram is, one of the diagrams that gives you interaction at second order post-Newtonian level. And this is for the conservative part, because you see here there's no emission of gravity waves. So this, they all contribute to the effective action of two bodies. And then you can do the same okay, I don't have time to tell you this. Trust me, quantum loops, they are zero here. They are just suppressed. Okay, I don't have time to tell you. You can ask me later. And then you can do the same for the radiative part. I mean, in the radiative part, I just let one graviton expand to the infinity. And you see, this is one of the contributions to the leading order dissipative part, to the leading order of the flux. This is one of the contributions to the first order correction to the dissipation of the system. And then you see, I mean, since I knew from the effective action I obtained before how the radiation graviton coupled to the effective two-body system, which I now model as a quadrupole, then, I mean, to compute the power emitted, I use the optical theorem, I cut this diagram, I take the imaginary part, and I recover, you know, the Einstein formula. But the good thing is that, I mean, I can do this at any order and recover all the correction to the leading Einstein formula. Okay, I understand this is, I mean, I'm I'm not giving you many details here, but this is just to tell you, I mean, for instance, one question that you might answer in this language is, okay, let's try to measure the tripole interaction vectors of the graviton and the quartic interaction vectors of the graviton. I mean, you know that LEP did it for the gauge fields. I mean, the tripole interaction vector of the gauge field and the quartic interaction vector of the gauge field has been measured by LEP with very high precision. We can do it with the coalescing binaries, because we just track how these tripole interaction vectors enter into the phase in the conservative part and in the dissipative part. Okay, let's forget about the quartic. We track how it enters. We just compute how it enters into the phase. And then let's go back and build the template with that parameter more. Let's build the waveform in which we allow these parameters on equal footing as the masses, say. And then let's determine it once we have the detection of gravity waves. Let's determine with the experiment, with the measure of the experiments. Okay. So basically, what you obtain is that this beta 3, I mean, let's forget beta 4 for the moment, they enter into the determination of the phase, they enter at some level. The problem is that usually when you once, hopefully, will detect a gravity wave, I mean, you don't know what are the physical parameters of the system. So you have to use the data to infer the physical parameters of the system and eventually this extra parameter that you have put in your template. So just by looking at the phase, it won't be enough, just because you have barely marginal enough information to determine the physical parameter of the system. You won't have enough information to constrain extra parameters that you added by hand to track new exotic physics. So basically, what should be done is not done yet, but there is work on that. One has to look not only for the main harmonic, but also to higher harmonics. If you manage to check in your signal, not only the leading harmonic, but also twice it, thrice it, and so on, then you have additional information that should depend on the same physical parameters. Then you will be able to constrain. The problem is that higher harmonics, they will be smaller in your detector. They will have an amplitude which is smaller. So you really have to go to high enough signal-to-noise ratio, so I mean over 1,000, to be able to constrain the physical parameters and the eventual extra parameters you want to put in your signal. So the bottom line, you should really expect that LISA is launched and can really see signals at 1,000 signal-to-noise ratio. Advanced LIGO and advanced VLIGO won't be able to signal at 1,000 signal-to-noise ratio. So, you cannot bound, for instance, on this beta 3 from the coalescing binary system, first, because you haven't observed, but second, even if you observe that for the reason I just said, but you can put a bound by checking the data of binary pulsars. But, I mean, this is just a curiosity. I mean, if you redo the computation of binary pulsar, allowing a beta 3, a tripole interaction vertex, which is different from the GR1, so it's 1 plus beta 3, beta 3 equal to 0 correspond to GR, then you will see that you cannot allow any deviation of that tripole interaction vertex from the GR value. And in particular, this deviation from the GR value of the tripole interaction vertex has to be smaller than this. So just by looking at the binary pulsar system. Or by looking at other systems, you can even get an even better constraint, but always in the same ballpark. So basically, and I conclude, sorry for taking so long. Basically, I mean, if you have a model for alternative gravity theory, and pick your effects, would it be scalar tensor gravity theory, would it be modified dispersion relation, some Chern-Simon tensor, I mean, whatever model you have, compute the energy function and the flux function, and that those in principle, with the caveats I told you, are observable in gravity wave observation. But you might have to wait till LISA flies. Okay, this is, okay, I don't have time to tell you about this. So okay, let's end here.
Questions for Cliff?
So in that last part with the Rossheim company,
yeah, basically said that was just, I mean, a kind of exercise. I mean, let's assume that.
I have a question.
Sure, please.
So has somebody calculated what those things are as functions of specific theories like Gransky theory or as various scalar tensor models? How the data is like that?
Yes, I mean, in principle you can, but Depending on which order you look at, the functional dependency is different. I mean, if you restrict it at 1pn order, you get some answer. So it depends what other approximation you want to look at. I mean, there are slightly different parameterization, say. It's not completely one-to-one matching. So these are some very effective parameters. In principle, I mean, I'm not allowed to change the triple vertex of gravity because I run into any problem of gauge, I mean, ghost and things. I mean, so this is not really a proposal for a new theory having that parameter.
But supposing I believe that Fransky is right, and I wanted to do the precision low energy description of the radiation out of Rothstein, right? Has that calculation been done?
In some specific, well, yes, with caveats. The caveats are that, Bransdyke, yes, because you don't allow for self-coupling of this extra scalar. If you allow for a self-coupling of this extra scalar, you have to consider them into account, and then, I mean, they all matter. So, not in the most general case, but yes. The answer is yes, but not in the most general case.
In Kaluza-Klein variables, you can eliminate this Y vertex, right?
You can eliminate, sorry, what?
Eliminate this Y diagram, this Y vertex. So the question is, in these variables, in Kaluza-Klein variables, to what vertex it corresponds?
Yeah, I mean, you can eliminate that from GR, but since I'm checking how this triple vertex deviates from GR, if I do the transformation, either I do the transformation that depends on beta 3, or it will appear. I mean, I agree with you. If I change variable in GR, I can get rid of this triple vertex.
So my question, to what kind of vertex it is related in this language?
It's the same. Basically, it's just that the transformation that you make gets rid of the GR part of it, but doesn't get rid of the extra part of it. So it's a phi cube interaction vertex. You know, the scalar that you get, no? I mean, That's the parameterization you're talking about. You parameterize the H0 part of the metric as a scalar. Yes. So the scalar in GR has no cubic self-interaction.
Yes.
If you like deviation from GR, yes.
Okay.
The questions? So if I understand correct, so the first post-Newtonian correction gives the estimate of the mass of the binary, and you go to higher post-Newtonian correction, get spin and the other parameters?
Roughly thinking, yes.
But then for the binary, there are like around 12 parameters, right, to model
them. Actually 15, yes.
Yes. So then in principle, you just have to...
Yeah, basically, this boils down to what I said. One thing is doing mesh filtering. So when you do mesh filtering, you don't want to play with many parameters. You want to play only with two, just because building template banks with more than two parameters makes the number of waveforms increase exponentially, and you no longer handle that. So you make a rough template bank with two parameters, and then once you have spotted an excess, you go and do the fully fledged analysis with all the 15 parameters using the Monte Carlo methods, but on a very selective chunk of data. That you can do it, because on a very selective chunk of data, I mean, basically just because it takes a week to run the Monte Carlo over a 2-second chunk of data, so you don't want to do for all the data. But if you have a pre-existing trigger, then you can do it, and then you determine all of the other parameters.
Raquel will be here until Thursday afternoon, so he's in the office here upstairs. Let's thank him again.